From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. On this episode, a Chicopee, Massachusetts lawyer who is a woman, African-American, and Muslim used to shy away from working on civil rights lawsuits on behalf of Muslim communities who feel threatened.
I've evolved from being a little bit more self-conscious about that work to openly embracing it because there's nothing for me to be ashamed of.
An interview with Tahira Amatul Wadud. Then the Berkshire Museum has an ambitious plan. To pay for it, the museum wants to auction off a bunch of art, including a pair of pieces from Norman Rockwell. So that's headed to court.
We want to keep the art from being in Dubai or Japan or someone's private home in Manhattan.
Speaking of museum controversies, we've got a commentary from a children's book author about another children's book author.
One of his more egregious cartoons depicts Japanese Americans lining up to receive bombs.
Grace Lynn calls for context when exploring the works of Dr. Seuss. And we hear about a musician who decided to look for American inspiration on Amtrak. He also decided
not to bring my phone, not to have any internet-connected device. I didn't read a newspaper, didn't watch television. I just talked to people on the train for 2 weeks.
Some beautiful music in that story. Just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, our friends at WNPR in Hartford recently returned from a reporting trip in Puerto Rico. Since Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico last month, the island has been working to reconnect basic infrastructure. Meanwhile, many New England residents with ties to the island have been working just as hard to reconnect broken family ties. WNPR's Jeff Cohen has this story of one man's effort to bring his children home to Hartford.
Guillermo Klaas just couldn't wait anymore. The reports he was getting from his two teenage sons living in Puerto Rico weren't good. Food and water were getting to them and their mother, but not enough.
I just spoke to my son the other day. He said they bought food, they bought water. It wasn't much, and whoever got, and whoever didn't get, you know? So for me to know that I'm in Hartford, Connecticut, I could wash 3 cars with all the water we got. I got a refrigerator full of food. And knowing that my kids are going through what, you know, practically going to bed hungry, I can't then.
So he did what he had to do to raise the cash to fly himself down and fly his boys with him back to Hartford, where they were born.
I had to sell my car to buy the plane tickets. I had to sell my vehicle if I could buy the plane tickets and have money in my pockets so I could get them out of Puerto Rico. And that doesn't bother me, because that's what you got to do as a father.
Klaas says he got $1,700 for his 2003 Jeep Liberty. It was in decent shape, he said, and he could have gotten more, but he was desperate. That's how he came to be among those on a direct flight from Bradley International Airport to San Juan. Also on the plane were 7 members of a Northwest Massachusetts emergency response crew on a 2-week mission to help with planning and logistics in Puerto Rico. Wearing matching T-shirts, the crew caught Klaas's eye back at the airport.
I even posted on Facebook. I said, look at this. First responders going on the same flight with me to Puerto Rico. And I was saying, God is good. It's not all that bad.
And it's a good thing all of them were there, because just after the plane took off, a woman started coughing violently and couldn't stop. Eventually, the Massachusetts crew was able to help stabilize her, and throughout, Klaas, who was sitting in front of her, calmed her and shared his own stash of brand new asthma inhalers.
I wasn't going to give her the used one, you know. So I figured, you know, she needs it. She needs it, you know. I don't care. I can always get another one when I come. But I got like 3 more.
Klaas says he grew up in the Bronx, but has lived for the past 15 years in Hartford. He was dressed in work boots so he could be useful when he's on the island, but his main goal was to get his boys. Just before he boarded the plane, he spoke with one of his sons.
Well, they can't wait. He was like, I can't wait. You know, I was in the airport now. And he was like, I can't wait to see you. I can't wait. You know, like, they just can't wait. I told him, don't worry, relax. I told you I'm going for you. I told him I'm going to pick you guys up. And I kept my word. I said, I'll be there in a few. I said, don't know, it's just a couple of hours and I'll be there. I told him, I'm going to get you out of Puerto Rico.
Woo! Once the plane landed, we had to run to keep up with Guillermo Klass as he went to meet his sons.
I don't know. One of them called me. There he goes. There you go. Right there. Those are my boys right there.
The three of them, William, Jomar, and Guillermo, hugged a lot. Then they stopped. Then they hugged some more as they waited for bags. The boys said they'd been okay. There'd been some food and some water, but they say they know that for a time, good opportunities will be hard to come by in Puerto Rico. So Jomar says he wants to go back to Hartford to finish school for his future.
For my future.
For your future?
Yeah.
Did everything last
year? And play baseball.
Hey, big boys. I haven't seen them in like 4 years. 5 years. ¿Cuántos años ya que no veía? ¿Cuántos años? About five years. Yeah. They're going back home with me, that's for sure.
For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Jeff Cohen in San Juan.
Now, an interview with someone in Western New England you really ought to know. In her day job, Chicopee, Massachusetts attorney Tahira Amatul Wadud does family law, divorce, custody, child support. But on her own time, she's filed civil rights lawsuits on behalf of Muslim communities who feel threatened, especially African-American Muslims like herself. In recent years, as the rhetoric against Muslims has intensified, so has Wadud's activism. She's on the board of the Council of American Islamic Relations and the Massachusetts Commission on the Status of Women. Wadud, a mother of seven, told New England Public Radio's Karen Brown she used to want people to see her as a lawyer first.
I didn't want to be identified as a Muslim lawyer, as an African-American lawyer, as a woman lawyer. I really just wanted to be a good lawyer. For a while, I would never even disclose that I was working on some of these cases for the Muslim community because I felt, one, self-conscious. I felt that people would say, what are you doing? Why are you associating with people charged with terror? Not charged, but rumored, and why would you do that to yourself? So I've evolved from being a little bit more self-conscious about that work to openly embracing it because there's nothing for me to be ashamed of.
Had you, I mean, you wear a hijab and you'd always been wearing one.
Yeah.
So you were already identifiable
yes.
as Muslim.
Yeah.
And as a woman.
Yes.
And as an African American.
Yeah.
And as a lawyer. So what was different?
That I could speak about it. That I could speak about those demographics. That I could talk about race. That I could talk about religion. That I could talk about double standard. I could talk about the unfair treatment that Muslims get when you compare the Muslim defendant to a non-Muslim defendant or a black defendant to a non-black defendant. Like, I could actually and would now speak about it in public.
Was there something about the political evolution of the country that gave you that sense, or was it more of an internal decision?
It was a little bit of everything. It was what was happening in the cases that I was dealing with. It was what was happening with the Muslim families that were coming to me for support, including employment advice with bullying in school. So I was getting this real life experience from the average person and realizing that this is a problem and I'm not doing anybody a service by not talking about it.
How have your other cases, your family cases, evolved, or have they? I mean, do you have just some run-of-the-mill divorce custody cases, or has even that part of your professional life been dictated in some ways by your values?
I love my family law practice. My clients are very diverse. Most of them are not my religion. Most of them are not my race.
Do you get nervous, or do you just even think about when you meet somebody what they're going to think, a potential client? Or is it self-selecting? People already know what you're about.
Usually, most of my clients know who I am, or they'll Google me, or they're not shocked when they see me. I used to say to them, you know, this is what I look like, this is what I dress like. So, you know, when you come upstairs, I just wanted them to know. But I'm at a point now where I don't see the shock that I sometimes used to see in their faces. I have a client who is a white man who told me recently, and we go back 5 years, but he told me last fall, he said, when I first came to your office, I wanted to leave. I said, she's not the one for me.
And what changed his mind?
He sat down and we talked about his case and he got comfortable. And ever since then, we've actually been friends.
Now, I'm curious, and I'm trying to think, would I ask a Christian lawyer this question? Possibly not. I mean, I should. But does your faith dictate any cases that you will not take?
Not really.
Do you deal with same-sex domestic issues?
Well, I always tell people that as a lawyer, when I took the oath that I would uphold the Constitution of the United States of America, the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the laws of Massachusetts, that's what I did. So, yeah, some of my work definitely overlaps in marriages that are same-sex.
And does that conflict at all with the Muslim faith?
The Muslim faith does condemn the act of homosexuality. That's not a secret. So when you look at it like that, if you're religious and you believe in the Muslim faith and some Christian faith and some practitioners of the Jewish faith, you're going to have people who hold true to that teaching.
But in your case, you sit with those contradictions and you are primarily a lawyer when you are a lawyer.
I'm a lawyer and we kick butt.
Tahira Amatul Wadud is a family and civil rights lawyer in Chicopee. Hearings are scheduled this week in Massachusetts courtrooms over the Berkshire Museum's plan to sell off 40 pieces of art. The money would go to fund renovations and boost its endowment. A couple of the works were donated by the late Norman Rockwell when he lived in the Berkshires decades ago. Lawsuits, one involving some of Rockwell's children, have been filed to stop the auction. New England Public Radio's Adam Frenier reports.
The Berkshire Museum here in downtown Pittsfield, well, it's been here a long time, since 1903. Its dozen arched windows look out on the busy South Street on this rainy fall afternoon, and Wally the Stegosaurus stands guard in the front yard. This place could be getting a massive overhaul if the people who run it get their way, some $40 million worth of renovations. The plan's been a controversial one, and it all started back in July.
The board and staff of the Berkshire Museum, after more than 2 years of extensive planning, have created a bold new vision for this beloved community treasure as an interdisciplinary museum focused on science, history, and the arts.
The so-called new vision was spelled out in a promotional video. It calls for more high-tech and hands-on exhibits along with renovations to the building. Officials say the current business model isn't working. They've carried a deficit of about $1 million over the last decade, and corporate giving has declined with major businesses like General Electric leaving Pittsfield. So they hope auctioning off the art will raise somewhere around $50 million. With the two Rockwell paintings headlining the sale. Attorney Jim Lammy thinks the plan is nonsense.
What is it, 18th century map of Berkshire County?
In his Great Barrington office, Lammy shows off that old map, one of many pieces of art hanging on the walls.
And I like it because it reminds me that we're all sort of tucked in together here. This isn't just about a museum in Pittsfield, this is about a museum that provides interesting things, art, for kids in Lee and for children in Sheffield and for children in Williamstown.
Lammy, who is a member of the museum, has joined with three of Norman Rockwell's sons to sue the museum, trying to halt the sale. The first pieces of work, including both Rockwell paintings, are scheduled for auction November 13th. The lawsuit claims the famed artist gave the paintings to the museum to be part of its permanent collection. Lammy says the museum's actions are unlawful and unethical.
We want to keep the art from being in Dubai or Japan or someone's private home in Manhattan. We want the art on display the way it was intended to have been shown.
There's been plenty of other opposition and scrutiny, too. State Attorney General Maura Healey's office is conducting its own probe into the proposed sale. An activist group has been holding protests in Pittsfield. The Massachusetts Cultural Council, a state agency that helps to fund nonprofits, including the Berkshire Museum, sharply criticized the proposal. And national museum groups have come out against it, too. Lori Fogarty is president of the Association of Art Museum Directors.
If museums began to, essentially use their collections as financial assets, that would erode the confidence of collectors and donors in giving artworks to museums.
Fogarty says widely held professional standards permit museums to sell art just for one specific purpose.
That the proceeds from the sale will only be used for future acquisitions to the collection.
And not to fund renovations or build an endowment, as the Berkshire Museum has proposed. The museum does have its supporters. The Berkshire Eagle reports Pittsfield Mayor Linda Tyer and State Representative Tricia Farley Bouvier both support the museum's plans. State Senator Adam Hines, he appeared in the promotional video touting the changes. And despite the loud backlash, the museum is not backing down. Elizabeth McGraw is president of its board.
I believe that the museum has the right to go forward, and we feel that the legal action is kind of factually and legally flawed. So we're confident that we'll be able to continue moving forward with our new plans and new vision.
McGraw says she isn't surprised by the opposition to the sale, but
we're surprised at their anger and nastiness, but you know, we're all trying to listen to everyone's side, and unfortunately they've been a little louder and we haven't really been able to get our message out as effectively.
Public relations was also a problem for a time at another museum that sold some of its art, the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington. Despite sanctions from industry groups, officials there decided in 2014 and 2015 to try and pay off an almost $20 million debt. Reporter Shirley Min of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia covered the story.
You know, there were critics who said that there still could have been more that the board could have done or could have sought out, but they were saying that the decision to sell four works of art was really a last resort.
It's not clear how successful the Wilmington sale actually was. That's because the museum sold some of the works, including pieces by Andrew Wyeth and Winslow Homer, privately and never disclosed the prices. But Min says the museum did announce it managed to retire its debt.
While the public might not have supported their sales of the works of art, they supported Delaware having its own art museum. And so even though they might not have been pleased with the decision initially, it was never going to get in the way of the community coming to rally around the museum to keep it here.
And officials at the Berkshire Museum are hoping for a similar outcome in Pittsfield with their new vision. But before anything can hit the auction block, they need to win in court. For New England Public Radio, I'm Adam Frenier.
Let's stay on museums for a bit. The Dr. Seuss Museum in Springfield has been dealing with a mural problem. Three kids' book authors who were invited to a museum event this fall backed out, saying a mural at the museum stereotypes Asians and that the museum isn't doing enough to give the artwork some important context. Dr. Seuss has a mixed record on race and prejudice, and the museum has come under fire for avoiding the subject in its displays. But it did acknowledge that a change is needed. Children's book author and illustrator Grace Lynn has a suggestion for what that change should look like.
All children's book creators worth their salt know the history of Dr. Seuss. We know that his early career was filled with racist propaganda. He drew horrible stereotypes of Jews, African Americans, you name it. One of his more egregious cartoons depicts Japanese Americans lining up to receive bombs. He drew that in 1942 when anti-Asian paranoia was at full tilt. He was a product of his time. Time passed, however, and Seuss began to regret his images. It's widely accepted that his book, Horton Hears a Who, was an apology for his earlier racist art. He went on to write many books with themes of inclusion and tolerance. Dr. Seuss realized the harm his work could do, and he did better. The controversial image being displayed at the Seuss Museum is from his first book printed in 1937. It includes the character of the Chinaman, who was originally depicted with bright yellow skin and with a long pigtail. In 1978, Seuss acknowledged that the image should be changed. The reconfigured character is now white and without a pigtail. But in 2017, we've come even farther. Even with Seuss's changes, I wince at the caricature with its squinty eyes. With so few Asians being represented in children's literature, it's painful that one of the few images we do see is a cartoon stereotype. Of all the images of this man's work, do we really need to show this one? In a Seuss museum, the answer is yes, but only if it's displayed with an explanation of Seuss's journey away from racism. It's important that viewers, especially children, know Dr. Seuss as he really was, a person affected by his time but able to grow beyond it. Seuss himself deserves that explanation. I wasn't asked to participate in the museum's event, but I can't fathom trying to read my books with this image behind me as it stands now without context. Yet, I proudly display his award sticker on one of my books. That's because I honor Dr. Seuss as a man who outgrew his racism and created some of the best works of children's literature. But I won't honor one of his offensive drawings unless it's clearly identified as part of his regrettable past.
Grace Lynn has written and illustrated more than a dozen children's books, including the National Book Award finalist When the Sea Turned to Silver. She lives in Florence, Massachusetts. Gabriel Kahane is a composer who thrives on big concepts. His last album, The Ambassador, is a sort of history of Los Angeles told through 10 of its buildings. His newest work is based on the nearly 9,000-mile train trip he took around the country last November, starting the day after Donald Trump was elected president. Kahane this fall spent 2 weeks in North Adams, Massachusetts, working on the material. New England Public Radio's Jeremy Goodwin has more.
There's been a flood of think pieces since the presidential election grappling with today's divisive cultural and political climate. It seems the Trump era so far has reminded us more about what we disagree on than what brings us together. So, is there a path towards some renewed sense of unity? Musician Gabriel Kahane has a suggestion.
Not to be Pollyannish, but I feel like we could do major, major cultural healing in the dining car of Amtrak trains.
That was the idea last year when he got on board at Penn Station about an hour after Hillary Clinton gave her concession speech. He spent the next 2 weeks crisscrossing the country.
I went New York to Chicago to Portland to Los Angeles to Chicago to New Orleans back to New York.
Along the way, Kahane had conversations with about 80 people on the train, mostly over meals in the dining car. Some of his new companions were as dismayed by the election as he was, and others were excited about trying to make America great again. He took notes along the way, and afterwards he wrote some songs.
And I want to tell you about November, the people that I met, and sleeping badly on Pullman pallets, a blue blanket caked in sweat. Cardio grandpa will lines heart of the Department of the Interior.
Kahane planned his train tour before the election, when he, like many others, assumed Clinton was going to win the presidency.
And of course, the election went the other way, which I think really deepened the trip for me. It went from being what I think might have been a kind of patronizing empathy tour of like, oh, these, who are these people who supported this guy? And instead, it became much more soul-searching and sort of personally vulnerable because I was in total shock.
That shock inspired a spontaneous decision.
Not to bring my phone, not to have any internet-connected device. I didn't read a newspaper, didn't watch television. I just talked to people on the train for 2 weeks. And I found it incredibly healing and incredibly edifying.
The vulnerability he felt on the trip is on display in the songs, which he performs alone on piano. Some are inspired directly by his conversations with fellow passengers. Others drift into daydreams about the country, cued by the passing scenery. Kahane aimed to consider not just the confused state of America today, but to step back and ask how we got here. And what's the best way out?
A long gray silence had ambled down the coast. You drew in sand all the things we'd miss the most. Little love, little love. Little love, little love.
Train travel may not have the romantic hold on the American imagination it once did. But Kahane found that it's still possible to turn your accidental table mates into fellow travelers. And in a divided country, maybe that's a pretty good place to start. For New England Public Radio, I'm Jeremy Goodwin.
We'll case the shore.
NEPR News Now is produced by New England Public Radio, a listener-supported public media company that brings you news and music, and NEPR.net. It's a cool website. Check it out, and while you're there, you can make a contribution to New England Public Radio. Click the orange donate button at the top of the screen. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, please leave a review for NEPR News Now. Until next time.